Last Sunday, we were given a glimpse into that new work that Jesus had been teaching about, and we read as 12 future apostles were selected out of a large pool of disciples, and immediately after Jesus updates their ministry ID cards to reflect their new promotions, if you will, he then immediately and intensely turns toward those 12 with an important sermon for them. It was a crash course on what they would go through in the ministry and how they were supposed to respond to the opposition that they would face. And as a side note, it's good for us to know that when we are doing ministry correctly, you will have opposition. You will have opposition. And to take that a step further, even if you're just minding your own business, not doing ministry, just minding your own business and desiring to live a godly life, the scripture promises for you persecution, right? 2 Timothy 3:12, we covered it recently. Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. No ifs, ands, or buts, just wills. You will. And Jesus said in our verses last week that if people are only ever speaking well of you, then you're doing something wrong. Because godly living and godly ministry will bring about worldly resistance. It's really ironic to read through the kind of character that the Lord wants to build into his people and then try to figure out why the world would want to oppose that character in us. You would think that the world would say, well, I don't believe in your Christ, but I like your Christianity because your Christianity is pushing you toward kindness and love toward me. But that's not the way the world responds to Christianity, is it? The way the world responds to Christianity is hostility. There's no way to explain that except to say that is a spiritual thing. It is demonically fed. The Apostle John put it like this: the spirit of Antichrist is already in the world. Doesn't matter how well you live out the things we're going to discuss here in this chapter, it's not going to win you the favor of the world because the spirit of Antichrist is in the world. So, here's the question. Because the statement is that the Christian minister and the Christian that is seeking a godly lifestyle will face persecution. And I know you could be thinking at that point, well, that's not a very helpful thing to tell us. It's definitely not a very exciting thing for us to be looking forward to. What we really need to know is how are we to manage our behavior in the face of that opposition and pressure that we get against our Christianity? And I'm glad you asked, because that is largely what Jesus is addressing in the remainder of this chapter. That is Christian behavior that is under pressure. The Lord does not have much to say here to your enemies. He just gave a handful of warnings, verses 24 through 26 that we covered last week. But his focus is on you, the Christian. The most important matter to the Lord is the conduct of those who have set their course for heaven. If that's your destination, that makes your journey very important to the Lord. What's more important, the journey or the destination? Well, the Lord would say both. Because your destination involves your journey. Your journey impacts your destination. So what we do on this journey of life matters a whole lot to the Lord. And before we read, here's an important truth you need to carry with you as we study down through this. I know you're not going to like it, but here it goes. God cares about people, all people, and not just you. I told you you weren't going to like it. And because God cares about all people, not just you, therefore God cares about how you, the Christian, treats people. In Matthew chapter 22, actually, just turn there real quickly with me, if you will. Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 40. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Now, Jesus gave that in response to a question about what the greatest commandment was. What's the greatest law in the scriptures? And Jesus actually had one. I'm surprised he didn't say, well, they're all equally important. Just do them all. But no, he actually had an order of importance. He said, this is number one. Your love for God. And this is number two. Closely behind it, your love for people. So in order of importance, Jesus said, first and foremost, the most important issue in your life is how things go between you and God. But that second one follows really closely behind. The second greatest command is this: how things go between you and people. That includes people that you like and people that like you. That includes people that don't like you and people that you don't like. It includes all of it. And that's what the rest of this sermon is about. So let's take a look. Verse 27. But I say to you who hear. I say to you who hear. What, were there a bunch of deaf people in the crowd that day? Was he speaking at a deaf and dumb conference? Well, actually, there were some deaf people in the crowd that day. Maybe not the way you're thinking, though. This is Jesus understanding something that not all who have physical hearing are able to truly hear his teaching, especially a teaching like this. This is tough for even seminary grads. But he understands not all people who have ears that work are able to hear his teachings and understand his teachings. Jesus, on quite a few occasions, is going to say that only those who have ears to hear will be able to hear, understand, and obey his words. And when he says that, he is referring to spiritual ears. Obviously, there weren't many people running around Jerusalem that didn't have ears on their head. No, they had ears. He was speaking about spiritual ears and spiritual hearing. And those spiritual ears that each person has the potential to open, they don't start open. You come into life dead in your trespasses and sins. And the Bible is very clear about it, that if our ears are to be open spiritually, that we can receive his truth, that has to be a work of God. That has to be done by him. And that's who Jesus is. He's the one that can open the ears of the deaf. That goes for the spiritually deaf and the physically deaf. And it's just as simple as the desire to want to hear his word and the prayer that he'll open up your hearing. And so he says this to those that have the ears to hear, the capacity spiritually. He says, love your enemies. Now, love can be passive or active. So Jesus is going to take us a step further in helping us to understand the kind of love that he's going to be talking about in these verses. He says this: love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. That takes love, and that clears up what kind of love he's speaking about. He's not speaking about passive love. He is speaking about active love. It is not good enough to love others, especially your enemies, from a distance, and tell your friends, well, that person hates me, but I love them. Come on. That's a passive form. That's not enough. You can do that sitting on your couch at home. Say you love someone. That's passive to say it. It's passive even to feel it. And so the Lord says, here's what he wants. He wants love for our enemies in an active form. That is, love as an action word. Love in the form of doing good to those who hate us. And you say, but they hate me. They have made themselves my enemy. They don't deserve my love. They don't deserve my goodness. Well, I already told you, this section isn't about them. and what they deserve or don't deserve, this section is about you. They, what they deserve and don't deserve, that's between them and God. This passage is about you because you're responsible and accountable for you. You're not responsible and accountable for them. And here's what's going to happen inside you when someone hates you and attacks you. Human nature that is left unchecked, human nature that is left to run its course, is automatically going to return hatred with hatred and enmity with enmity. Because that's emotion and that's reflex. Emotion is the default mode of the human being that is living in the flesh. And that makes this the first thing that you're going to have to abandon if you want to live out the principles that Jesus is teaching you. The first thing that you are going to have to abandon is human emotions and emotional responses to people that are pressuring you or people that are hating you. Just so you know, Jesus is not telling you what to feel here. He's not saying, I want you to feel love for people. This is not about emotion. Jesus is not talking about emotional love. He's not telling you what to feel. He is directing you in what to determine in your heart. He's not telling you to feel love for your enemies. He's telling you to choose to love them. Why would he do that? Well, he can do that because he understands that human emotion is controlled by human will. Human emotion doesn't always go down easy or comply gently, but human emotion will follow the decisions that you make with your will. So Jesus is saying, if I'm telling you to love your enemies, that means it's a decision that you can make, and the rest of your human emotions, your feelings, all of that stuff will follow suit. It'll catch up, and it's true. It works. One of the most common objections to loving people that hate us or loving our enemies is this: why should we let them off the hook? They hate us. They're our self-proclaimed enemies. They've done some terrible things to us. And we say, Lord, if I am kind to them in return, if I love them back, then I'm letting them off the hook. But that's not what this is about. You're not letting people off the hook. If you're letting anyone off the hook by loving like Jesus said to love, it's you that you're letting off the hook. You're delivering your heart from something that, believe me, you don't want in there. It starts out as a little bit of anger, frustration, and it ends up burying itself as a seed, as a root of bitterness down in you, and that grows up and produces evil fruit in your life. It'll control you. It'll destroy you. So you're doing yourself a favor by letting yourself off the hook when you forgive and when you love. So, who's out already? Who's done? All right, thank you very much for coming. Have a nice day. We hope to see you next week. No, I'm kidding. Don't leave yet. Don't worry, there's going to be some help in this chapter. We're going to make some sense of it. Right now, we're talking about some near impossibilities, but we're going to find some help in here. Verse 28, bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you. Now, when someone curses you, you are to return blessing. Not an easy thing to do. What is cursing in the Bible? We've said it before. It's not just foul language. It's not just being called a name that you don't like to be called. But cursing is praying or wishing ill upon another person. So you've probably been guilty of this, whether you realize it or not. Maybe you think, well, I don't curse because I don't say four-letter words. Well, you might not be off the hook. Because cursing is any ill that you're wishing on another person. So like when you're driving down the road, going the speed limit, or at least that's your story, and that person blazes past you at 90 miles an hour. Have you ever thought something similar to this? Lord, I hope they go down the road 2 miles and get pulled over and ticketed $200. Well, that's exactly what cursing is. Do they deserve it? Yeah, they do. You probably deserve it too because you were probably speeding too. Do they deserve it? Yes. But that still does not excuse us in our act of cursing another person, wishing ill on them. And we're going to tie this all in together. There's a major reason why you don't want to do that with other people. Curse them. Because you're going to find in life that sometimes you're not always doing the wrong thing. Sometimes that's you that just blazed past someone at 90 mile an hour. And you wouldn't wish that same cursing upon yourself, would you? No, you're praying for mercy from the law at that time. So, now we look at this incredible strategy that the Lord has given to us to help out against those that are trying to purposefully take advantage of us out of spite. You know, like your salesman at the car dealer, trying to purposefully take advantage of you, padding numbers into those final numbers that you don't even know what they're about and what they're for, taking advantage of you purposefully. I don't know why I come down hard on car salesmen here. I don't know why I do that. I've actually had pretty good experiences with them, but I guess it's just the image we all have of salesmen. But look, the Lord gave us a really good strategy for how to handle those that are trying to take advantage of us. And I think all of this goes into this category. How to handle those that hate us, how to handle our enemies. Here's what Jesus said to do. He said, you can pray for them. It's a great method. And you say, well, you better believe I'm going to be praying for them. Just like King David prayed for his enemies. Lord, break their teeth in their mouths. Yeah, I'm going to be praying for them, all right. No. That's not the kind of praying Jesus is talking about. That's going to fall back into that whole cursing thing, right? Lord, let something bad happen to them, and here, let me help you. I'll punch their teeth in. No. Not that kind of praying. But the kind of praying that we're speaking about here is praying without cursing, not wishing any ill on them, but praying blessing. Praying blessing on their life. Now, I know that sounds just terribly impossible, but listen, it's not that difficult. Instead of praying, Lord, how dare them disagree with me? Go get them. Destroy their life until they learn their lesson. Not to cross me. Instead of praying things like that, we simply pray this. Lord, how about if you work some major transformation in that person's life? Lord, how about if you change the way that they respond to me because of the work that you do in their heart? Lord, set up those opportunities where they might be saved, where they might come to know you. Those are prayers of blessing, and it's not that tough to do. Because here's the incredible thing about that approach. Your prayers may change them and may not change them. That's between them and God. But your prayers are always going to change you. Because we as people, we get very invested and interested in the things that we pray for. When we are praying for others, let's just take the easy route first. People we love. When we're praying that the Lord would heal them or help them in a situation, what do? We're constantly checking up. Hey, how are they? You want to know how your prayer investment is going. You want to know if your prayer is working. So you're going for those checkups. Are they better? Has their need been met? You become interested in the well-being of that person because you're praying for them. And maybe it doesn't come quite as quickly or naturally, but when you pray for your enemies, the same thing happens. You find yourself no longer looking out of the corner of your eye, hoping that they trip and split their skull open and things like that. But you find yourself watching them out of the corner of your eye to see if there are changes in their character, to see if the Lord is transferring them and transforming them. Because let's face it, the best way to handle your enemies is to change where they stand in relation to you. You want them to be a friend, not an enemy anymore. So prayer for them is the best thing, not a competition. Lord, you bless me and curse them. But prayer for their well-being. James 3, verses 10 through verse 12 says this, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or grapevine bear figs. Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. Let not cursing and blessing come out of your mouth at the same time, right? Verse 29, to him who strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And we are talking about the cheeks on your face here. Not the other cheeks. We're not talking about getting your butt kicked. We are talking about self-defense and retaliation. Now, this gets tough. The things that the Lord is teaching, this is hard-hitting stuff. It's not stuff that we can just accept and put into practice without some real challenge. On the issues of self-defense and retaliation, when someone punches you in the face, what are your two most natural responses? Your first reflex is either, yes, it's either to protect for that next shot, to defend yourself from that next shot that might be coming, or to wind back and deliver a knuckle sandwich yourself to that person. Those are going to be your two human reflexes, your two responses that come naturally. That's what the flesh is going to do by reflex. And please don't think here when you read this verse that Jesus is suggesting that you should be a physical punching bag for someone. Keep in mind who we're listening to. He is teaching those of us who have ears to hear what he's saying. In other words, he is teaching spiritual people spiritual truths. And here's what he really wants you to know. Simple truths like this: let God be your defense and let God handle retaliation. I'll give you two verses and I'll let you think through this on your own. Psalm 62:2, as it pertains to your self-defense. We read a verse very similar to this recently. It says, he only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. You might be moved a little bit, but I shall not be greatly moved. Did you see this week that Arnold Schwarzenegger, at 71 years old, was at a school event, and he was over there with his camera, all smiles, taking selfies with some of the students there, and out of nowhere, this rather good-sized man runs full force at this 71-year-old Arnold Schwarzenegger, and drop kicks Arnold Schwarzenegger in the back at full force. Arnold Schwarzenegger was not even expecting it, didn't know he was coming. He's 71 years old. That guy gave Arnold Schwarzenegger everything that he had. And all I can say is this: Arnold Schwarzenegger was not greatly moved. He couldn't even knock the guy down. That's a solid man. And spiritually, we can be the same way. The Lord is our defense. He builds up our muscles. I know Arnold has had many years of building up his muscles. So at 71 years old, well, he still looks like he could be in competition. So he's had years to build himself up. The Lord will do that for you and prepare you. You may take some shots. You may get jostled a little bit in life. You're not going to be greatly moved. He's your defense. As it pertains to retaliation, this one's cut and dry. Romans chapter 12, verse 19. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Who handles vengeance? Who handles retaliation? Not you. Forget about that knuckle sandwich. Not you. It's the Lord's job, and he will, and he'll do a better job than you could. So let him handle it. Reading on, he says, and from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. You say, finally, thank goodness, here's something that doesn't apply to me. I don't have a cloak or a tunic. But hang in there, because I'm going to make this applicable. I'm going to put it in modern terms. Let's say someone steals, men, your button-down shirt. This does not apply to women, by the way. Someone steals your button-down shirt. Jesus is saying, here's what you should do. If someone has stolen your button-down shirt, your outer garment, or they have taken it by force, you ought to just take off your undershirt too and say, here you go. I want to make sure you have the matching set. About a year ago, I had someone while I was at work. I worked a midnight shift at the time. It was a tough job. I worked about 4 hours a night. Drove a truck. But for those 4 hours that my vehicle was sitting there, someone somehow broke into my vehicle. I still don't know how they did it because there was nothing pried or broken. The car was locked when I got there. Everything looked normal. They must have had one of those, you know, professional police things that they jam down in the side and just pop it open and break in that way. They must have had something like that. But anyway, I come back and my camera, my drive camera that my Aunt Liz and my Uncle Barry had bought me for a gift was stolen. And, you know, you know how you feel when someone steals something from you, someone breaks in, you feel really violated. There is a feeling there you just can't explain. You're just sick. Someone stepped all over your rights, your belongings. That hurts. And that was how I responded, and that was pretty much the end of it, just to be hurt and feel bad for that person that stole from me. But here's what Jesus is saying. If I could track that guy down and find him, here's what I'd do when I tracked him down and found the person, I'm just going to assume it's a guy, that stole my drive cam. Instead of turning him into the authorities, perhaps I should do something like this. Here, glad I found you. I just wanted you to have the box it came in and the manual. I want to make sure you know how to use it. God bless you. These are things that are so against the grain of how we are programmed. So if someone takes away your cloak, give them your tunic also, right? Verse 30, give to everyone who asks of you. This is not getting easier. The further we read, the further we're burying ourselves. Give to everyone who asks you, everyone. And from him who takes away your goods, do not ask for them back. All right, that drive camera is his for life, even if I find out who it is. So, if we gave, like the Lord is saying here, to every single person that asks us for something, we would have nothing left. We would give away everything. Paul mentioned this in our Sunday school lesson this morning. If I gave all that I had to feed the poor, right? Well, Paul makes sure to say, if you're doing that kind of stuff, you better make sure there's love mixed in it. But what Jesus is saying here is challenging, because if I give to everyone that asks of me, well, before long I'm going to have nothing, because people are going to catch on. Arlen doesn't tell anyone no. I just got his house. Really, I just got his car. So this is getting tough. We make big statements as Christians like this. We say, Lord, I give my life completely to you, and everything that I have is yours. And that sounds so pious. And yet, when we say that, a lot of times what we're really saying is that, Lord, I care so much about my possessions and the things I own that it's going to take you to pry them away from my hands, because no one else is getting them. That's what I mean when I say I give you everything, Lord. So, we certainly do not comply with this principle on a 100% consistent basis. I have turned down plenty of people in my lifetime. People that have asked me for things, and I said, look, I can't give that to you. I need that. It's the only one I have, and I can't afford to replace it right now, so I need to keep it. I can't give it to you. Well, that's a big statement. Listen, there's something that we need to understand about Christ's Sermon on the Mount and his Sermon on the Plain. These were preached with only one thing in mind, and that is perfect righteousness. They were not preached with human feasibility in mind. He did not preach these things because he said, well, I'll word it like this because I know the church will be able to handle it. When he gave his word, when he gave his commands, he was not giving those with human feasibility in mind. He had one thing in mind, and that was God's standard for perfect righteousness. And so when we read things like this that are extremely difficult to stack our lives up against, what do we do? Because that is setting the bar awfully high. It is to teach us that we are not as great as we think we are. It is to teach us that if we'll look real hard at how we live our lives and handle the principles, we will see our own selfishness built right into the things that we do. If I had that one thing, like I mentioned, someone asked me for it and I said, I can't. It's that one thing I have. It's the only one I have. I can't replace it and I need it. When I do that, what am I doing? I am putting my own importance and my own need above yours. These are things that are supposed to make you feel guilty. When you come against scriptures like this, verses like this, I want to assure you that the Word of God is having the right effect within you. If you feel guilty because you're not measuring up, well, that's what the Word was supposed to do in that case. Romans 3:19 says this, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped." In other words, in order to shut you up about how great you are and how spiritual you think you are and how righteous you think you are, to shut you up, to stop your mouth, and that all the world may become guilty before God. Did you realize that was the purpose of the Old Testament law? See, that was the problem with the scribes and the Pharisees. They didn't realize that. They thought, no, the law is given to us that we might be perfectly obedient to those standards. It's not why God gave the law. Paul will say it over and over in his writings. God gave the law to show you not human feasibility, but God's perfect righteous standards. And the conclusion that you are supposed to come to when you read the Old Testament law and the words, the commands, and principles of Jesus is this: God's standards are awfully high, and I need help. I need something called mercy. I'm going to remind you again that Jesus concluded Matthew chapter 5 by saying this: be as perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Can you comply with that one? All right, maybe you can give away your undergarment when someone takes your outer garment. Maybe you can pray for those who are despitefully using you. Maybe you can love those that hate you. Maybe you never turn anyone down, and when someone asks you for something, you give it without hesitation. By the way, we should talk. Maybe you've got all of those things down, but in this same very type of sermon that Jesus preached in Matthew 5, he concluded chapter 5 by saying this: be as perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. I can't do that. I'm going to come to something in the law. I'm going to come to something in the words of Jesus where I say, Lord, I just don't know if I can do that. I don't know if it's possible for me. I'm too selfish to give to everyone that asks me. You tell me that you're getting a check for $31,000. And I have no trouble seeing that we are equal. And that my need is as important as that person's need with the $31,000. And being the reasonable man that I am, I say, well, don't give me the whole thing. Just give me half of the $31,000. Because we're equal to God. He cares about both of us just as much. But then when I'm the one that gets the check for $31,000, guess what I forgot? That person is equal with me, and they're not getting half. Guess who's getting all of it? I'm getting all of it. Because what I've done is I've seen myself as more valuable. It's selfishness is what it is. It is showing us these areas that we fail in, not so that you live a life in guilt and shame because you can't stack up to the things that he has given you as principles and commands. But why? That you might, for all of your life and every step of your Christianity, be dependent on his grace and his mercy. When I get to heaven, well, hold that thought. I think I'll close with that. Verse 31. And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise. Well, I would like half of that $31,000. That's what I'd like. That's what I'd like for myself. If I were them, I wouldn't do that though. I'd want all of it for myself. This is what we call what? Verse 31 is what? It's the golden rule. The golden rule. Anyone who has even heard about Christianity in passing has probably heard about the golden rule. Here it is. It is probably the greatest statement ever made concerning our behavior as Christians toward others. And it's not completely unique to Christianity. Oh, it had its origins in Christianity. Jesus came up with this. But many other religions and beliefs and practices have adapted something similar to this. Many Jewish rabbis like Hillel had a similar rule. Many Greek philosophers like Socrates had a similar rule. Confucius had a very similar rule. Buddha had a very similar rule. But their rules, their takes, their versions of the golden rule were all weaker than Jesus's golden rule was, because theirs were all delivered in the form of a negative. They all go something like this: don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you. That's a negative form. It requires no action. Again, it's something you could do sitting on your couch. All right, I wouldn't want that guy to walk up to me and punch me in the face, so I'm not going to walk up to him and punch him in the face. That's a good rule. That's a good thing. But it's a passive rule. It's a negative rule. And what Jesus does is he makes this golden rule as strong as it can be. He says, no, it's just not passive, refraining from doing the things that you wouldn't want done to you. But it's active. It's this: doing to others what you would want them to do to you. So I think we could come up with a new acronym here. Have you heard the acronym WWJD? What would Jesus do? We could come up with a new acronym for the golden rule. It'd be this: WWIW. What would I want? What would I want? That's what you're going to start asking when you're trying to apply this principle. What should I do to that person? Well, what would I want them to do to me? Are they in need? Okay, well, if I was in that same position, what would I want that person to do to help me? And so it is a very active, engaged kind of expression of our love for people. Continuing along this line of actions of love and giving that cost you something, because that's really what this is talking about, refraining from doing what you wouldn't want done to you, that costs you nothing. But actively doing for others what you would actively want done for you, that costs you something. That costs you work. That might cost you finances. That might cost you the suppression of human emotions. It costs you something, though. And following along those lines, Jesus says this, verse 32. But if you love those who love you, big deal. Big whoop. What credit is that to you? For even sinners who care nothing about morality, know nothing of a moral code, even sinners love those who love them. That's really easy. You love me and talk good about me, you'll get the same in return. That comes natural. Verse 33, and if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Big deal. Even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. Verse 35, but love your enemies, do good, and lend, hoping for nothing in return. Wouldn't it be great if that was the bank policy of every bank? Lend, hoping for nothing in return. I'm going to show this verse to my bank that financed my Renegade. Here's a loan, $150,000. All right, when's my first payment? Don't worry about it. We got you. But no, Christian, Don't just love and loan with your best interest in mind, knowing that there's going to be a return, knowing that you're going to get paid back. There's nothing notable or different about that. The unsaved can do that. The banks can do that. They will loan to you with their best interest in mind, 16% every month. That's easy. There's nothing challenging about that. There's nothing about that that distinguishes you as a child of God in whom the Holy Spirit dwells. So you give, you loan. You loan to those that you know can't pay you back. And you don't expect it. Whatever they do, not your concern. You give and you let go. This is what the Lord is saying. And you will lose a lot of stuff like that. You'll lose a lot of stuff like that, but guess what? You'll be like the Lord. Reading on, he says, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and evil. Now, in the Matthew 5 version of this, Jesus adds this. He makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good. And he sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Even if they are sinful, evil, and unjust, God is still kind to them. Their crops still get sunshine and rain. Unless they live in Pennsylvania, then it's just mostly rain. God is as good to them as he is to you, even though we would say they don't deserve it. The Lord loves you madly, but he loves them too. And here's really the thing. If you love the Lord, then you're going to love the people that the Lord loves, and that's everyone. We talked about that, I believe, in Sunday school this morning, too. Our subject was love. That's what our subject is right now, love. You're getting a full dose of teaching on love today. So that one that's rude to you, that one that hates you, that one that takes advantage of you, that ex that cheated on you and left you, anything that you faced, the worst person you've come up against in life, well, they're all part of that everyone that God speaks about when he says he loves everyone. Verse 36, therefore be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. Here you go. Here's your task to walk away from this chapter with. Therefore, be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. So, be as merciful as God is. Does that sound doable to anyone? I think that sounds pretty tough. I have never been able to equal God's mercy for another person. I've never been able to come close to it. But here's the command. Try to match God's mercy for others. Try to be as merciful to them as God is to them. Or how about this? Try to be as merciful to others as God is to you. And you can always tell people, you can always identify people that have experienced God's mercy on deep levels. Because here's the way that comes out. Mercy to other people. You're not going to be loving or kind or merciful or any of these things to people that don't deserve it if you have not first experienced these things from the Lord. And so here's the kicker. Here's the key to the whole message. How do we live this stuff out? Well, first of all, you're going to fail these things on a quite consistent basis, not for lack of effort. But you are going to fail these things. Believe me, Jesus knew that when he gave us these principles. So you're going to have to stay rooted to your humility and dependent upon his mercy toward you. That mercy is where you got your start in spiritual life. And that mercy should be something that's pouring out of you. But as you try to fulfill these principles and live these principles, here's the main thing you got to walk away with. How do I do this, Lord? Is the key to the whole thing just reading it more often and trying harder? Is that the key, Lord? Trying harder. No, that's not the key. The key to this stuff is this, not trying harder, but knowing him better. Because when you experience mercy on those deep levels, that deep mercy comes out of you toward other people. When you've experienced God's love, then your love toward others happens. When you've been given great blessing from the Lord, you can be praying those great blessings on other people. It's not about trying harder with human strength. It is about knowing Him better and experiencing these things with Him. And once you receive and experience these things with Him, they will begin to flow out of you.